Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact.
I think go into one of these emerging fields, like go into genetics, go into areas of biology where there are tools being developed that shine a new light on processes, and then use them, and you will discover stuff, and that could become the basis of new companies and new research.
My guest today is Lachlan McKinnon. Lachlan is principal at Oxford Sciences Innovation, an investment company formed to turn Oxford University's world-beating science into world-changing companies. Lachlan studied chemistry at Oxford and has worked on technologies ranging from super-resolution microscopy to vaccine innovation. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did your love of science and science applied to thorny social problems come from?
Well, I was a trained chemist originally. And during my kind of last year doing research, I got interested in a concept called the diffraction barrier, which is most people haven't heard about. But it's probably, in my view, the one concept in science that stopped us from understanding biology as we should. If you think how much innovation there is left to go in medicine, I think the diffraction barrier is probably the one thing you could point to that's most responsible for that. What it is essentially a concept which says there's a size beyond which you cannot resolve in microscopy, and it's about 500 nanometers. And what's interesting about that is below that is where all the interesting stuff happens in cells. So we're essentially blind to the fundamental workings of life and how biology works. So I got interested in technologies which could allow us to see beyond this barrier uniquely. And I thought that by investing in them and developing them, we could democratize access to this kind of information, and that would, if we made that available to the right people, this would drive a lot of innovation in biomedical research. So that's where my kind of curiosity started, and that's where my research led to. And then later at OSI, I've been involved in developing businesses around that area.
So let's geek out for a moment.
Absolutely.
And just tell us a little bit about what you've been able to do, which is sort of get beyond this fundamental barrier. How is it that you have been able to peer into realms that were previously invisible?
It starts about 2006 with a kind of collection of breakthroughs that were published, which kind of allow you to circumvent this barrier. And that actually led to a Nobel Prize in 2014 for kind of super resolution microscopy. What we're doing with a new business called Oxford Nanoimaging is we're essentially taking this capability, and we're packaging it in a way that essentially anyone can use it. So, and by doing that, and then by connecting the researchers who have access to this technology, we're kind of centralizing the data, and that is a way of massively speeding up research.
So give us an example of data that you can now access or democratize that enables you to solve or begin to solve problems that hitherto have not been solved.
Right, so when you can see structures at below 500 nanometer resolution, there's a whole world in there. There's actually a lot of space. Like if you think about the nucleus of a cell, it's got 2 meters of DNA. If you were to unwind all the 3 billion bases packaged into a tiny, tiny space. However, at that size, it seems enormous, if you can imagine. There's a huge number of things that are just starting to come out when you can see biology at this resolution. One of them is called, there's a new natural particle called exosomes. These are just starting to get into the news. These particles are kind of, they're given off by every cell, and it's a new means by which cells communicate with others. So each cell will throw off about 10,000 an hour. They travel around the whole body, and they're like the conductor orchestrating the concert that is your entire body's function. And the complexity is just astounding. So with tools like the ones we're developing, we can now see these exosomes, where they're going, why they're going from one place to another, what they're carrying. And this essentially becomes a whole new kind of modality which we can attempt to make therapeutic entities out of. So by harnessing the power of exosomes, we can essentially load them with novel therapies and deliver them to any tissue in the body. That's the dream.
And is your theory that these exosomes actually play a role in pathology and disease, in human health, in the vitality of the body? I mean, what's your theory if they've only recently discovered? What do you think they do?
They are crucial in pretty much every single biological process. So if you imagine you've got 37 trillion cells in your body, each of them are throwing off 10,000 exosomes an hour. So these are big numbers. Lots of information being transferred between cells in this manner. If we can kind of hack this network, we will be able to reprogram all kinds of pathologies. So there's increasing evidence that cancer is not driven by necessarily by mutation, but by exosomes thrown off from unhealthy cells, traveling to nearby ones and causing metastasis.
How recently is it that we've discovered these? So just to be clear, up to now, we haven't known that these have existed, these particles?
It's really interesting, actually, because it actually goes back to Darwin. And there's a fascinating story about this, which is another element of what I'm interested in. Darwin was around in about 1850, and he obviously is known for his theory of natural selection, which he's famous for, which we remember, which is essentially that the strongest elements of a species survive and they're the ones that prosper. However, he didn't believe this was the main mechanism of evolution, actually, but we've kind of forgotten this communally. He had another theory, which was called the theory of pangenesis, which said that it was an attempt to explain the variation generation to generation. So you have a lot of children, there's some variation present, natural selection acts on that variation. He thought that variation couldn't possibly be random, but it was potentially directed by the experiences of the parents, which is something that we're starting to hear about these days again with epigenetic inheritance and concepts like that. Darwin hypothesized that there must be some kind of particle that during your life travels from your bodily tissues to your sexual organs in order to pass on information that could be useful about the state of the environment. And he called them gemmules. And they share all of the core features of exosomes. So amazingly, he predicted exactly 150 years ago both the size, the capability of these tiny particles that must exist were his second theory about evolution to be true. So today, with modern tools like the ones I'm describing, we can see these exosomes. We can see what they're doing. So it not only sheds a lot of light on potential biomedical breakthroughs, but on new theories of evolution as well.
And if your theory is right, that these exosomes do what they potentially, what you hypothesize and what Darwin 150 years ago intuited, that they would do, how big of a breakthrough is this? Like, just help us think through, is this just a total step change in the way we understand genetics and biology and the human body? And are we on the cusp, therefore, of just unimaginable sets of breakthroughs?
I think the ability to harness the power of exosomes will be truly revolutionary. And the combination of the tools that can study them and the ability to modify them and deliver them will drive a huge number of new therapies. What's so cool about them is that they have a tissue specificity. So you can give them into people's blood, and you can direct very specific molecules to very specific places, which is essentially the dream of like treating disease and cancer and all kinds of problems. I think there are two businesses that are getting quite big focused around this. There's one in the States. There's one that we're involved in Oxford that are kind of the pioneers, the kind of early adopters. I think we're going to see a whole industry around this.
So give us some one or two real world examples that if you're right, you will be able to do things that you were not previously able to do. A disease you're able to treat, a pathology you're able to contain. Tell us, give us some real world practical examples.
Right. So, for instance, delivering drugs directly to cancers sounds easy, but right now, you know, the way we treat cancers is with systemic poisoning of the body. So the ability to deliver a payload that can adversely affect cancer directly to it in the blood using an exosome will be revolutionary. So that's one. And then the other is the blood-brain barrier. So this is a barrier that exists between the blood and the brain, as it as the name suggests.
It says it on the tin.
It's a kind of obvious why it's there. You don't want all the contents of the blood going directly into the brain. It's a privileged environment. This means it's very difficult to get drugs across it. So this is really what's hampering Alzheimer's, dementia, and Parkinson's research. It's not can we come up with interesting compounds that do things, it's can we get them into the right spot in the brain. So the other core feature of exosomes is they cross this barrier. So we'll be able to access regions in the brain which we currently cannot. With potentially, we might have already developed therapies that would work, but we'll be able to deliver them.
Tell us how this might apply or not to work that you've done in vaccines, or is that an entirely separate a kind of field of study?
In the work I've done, I think the vaccine stuff is slightly separate. Vaccines it's a lot simpler. They're one of the best medical interventions, actually. It's amazing if you look at the stats in terms of two interventions that make a difference. The first is clean water. The second is vaccines. And those two are ahead of all the others by about an order of magnitude in terms of the impact they make to human health. In a way, in terms of drug development, vaccinology is one of the easier fields. We have another business developing novel therapies against two infectious diseases which affect children and pregnant women. One of them's called cytomegalovirus, and the other one's called respiratory syncytial virus. And they both are very, very large unmet needs. There's no current vaccine for them. And again, we've got a kind of enabling technology that allows us to very uniquely develop products for these indications.
Do you think you have the vaccines? Are you en route to them? Where are you in the process?
We're done with product development, so now we are making bulk vaccine, and we'll be going into trials within about 12 months.
Help me understand something about the kind of economics of vaccines, because on one level, obviously, there's the innovation, what you do in order to develop an effective vaccine. And then there is kind of the politics and the economics of delivering them at scale and getting them to target populations and then getting populations to adopt them in sufficient numbers so that you can start actually creating immunities to a disease. Do you think of yourself as the innovator and then you hand over the economics to the WHO or to Big Pharma to get them to deliver it? Or do you also see yourself as sort of trying to go from the innovation to the actual adoption by target populations?
This is a huge debate in the entire biotech field. You know, how far do you go on your own? And at what point do you need to partner with a pharmaceutical company, which essentially gives you a loss of control? And a loss of control of the development and then the marketing distribution of your product. We're still at the early days of developing this vaccine. I think if all things go well, it could be on the market in between 6 and 10 years time. This is actually kind of a short time in drug development. The one thing we're being really conscious of from the early stages is we want the cost of goods to be as low as possible, so that there is the potential to do widespread marketing. If you have an expensive product, then you will always be limited to niche, not niche, but Western markets. So we're building our novel vaccine on an existing platform which it's basically built on the Hep B vaccine, which has sold billions of doses and has a very low cost of goods. So at least, regardless of the route we end up taking, the cost of goods will be low enough to support a global strategy.
Tell us a little bit about your views on the tension between kind of regulation, control trials, testing, and the kind of radical potential that some of these breakthroughs have, and the therefore almost kind of moral necessity of speeding them to market. And so when you're dealing with, you know, radical breakthroughs on telomeres that can extend human life, or cancers that can just change a very thorny and knotty disease problem, or suberin in roots which can cause them to quadruple the amount of CO2 that they can draw down and sequestrate in soil, it seems that science is accelerating in ways that can be truly revolutionary, both for the climate and for people. And on the other hand, we want to responsibly regulate. Do you think that we have the balance right?
I think there's an increasingly progressive attitude towards this. And it's now often the case that people actually start developing therapies against very, very nasty diseases because they know that if it starts showing efficacy, they can just roll the trials over into bigger and bigger trials and go straight to approval. There's also an increasing amount of what's called off-label use. So when a drug is approved for one thing, doctors know it works in another disease. They don't need to do trials in that disease. They just start prescribing it, and then it gets a kind of following. So that's a kind of another way of bypassing these immense hurdles towards getting something that works to the people that need it. And then there are other businesses actually founded just on manufacturing distribution of more simple therapies, but actually getting them to the hospitals at the right time and the logistics challenge can be a business in itself. So I'd say those three things are there's a very progressive attitude towards those strategies.
To what extent does your work and your research bump into the broad field of genetics, and to what extent, in the kind of activist community, there seems to me to be almost a kind of schizophrenia around questions of genetics, genetic modification. There's a strain of the kind of progressive activist community that thinks that this is Frankenstein and dangerous and playing with nature, and foods need to be properly labeled and we need to avoid this at almost all costs. And there's another group of people who are sort of more technophilic, as it were, who think that this research is wildly important and it's going to lead a lot of breakthroughs. And so help us through, if somebody who's, you know, deep science but also clearly cares about positive impact, talk through how you think about it, firstly, and how you might engage with a skeptic around the kind of costs and benefits of genetic modification.
I think maybe we can kind of leave aside the whole food argument, which has a very curious kind of less progressive attitude in Europe versus the States, where they're quite comfortable eating GM food. In terms of human genetic modification, we've just seen the first example of a scientist kind of going rogue and doing this in China and, selectively modifying a disease-causing gene in a baby. And thus, when that child gets born and it grows up and has offspring of its own, this change is now in the gene pool. So we've got an artificial change that's going to spread throughout humanity going forwards. I think it's highly unlikely in that case anything bad is actually going to happen. However, there are these tools these days to very selectively base edit genomes, which are incredibly cheap and easy to use. So I'm sure there are things happening which we don't know about. The other thing I think people get very confused about in genetics is the kind of person-to-person differences being super important and having the power to explain phenomena. In the reality of it is, we all basically have the same genome, and it's not what it's not our differences that are important. It's how that same genome is read out in different cell types and why. So I think there's kind of an interesting, like just obvious phenomenon that we've got these 37 trillion cells in our body. They're all doing very different things. However, they all contain a full copy of the entire genome. So how does the same instructions get read out so radically differently in different cell types? I think this is a much more interesting problem than just doing than the kind of 23andMe, you know, like where are your grandparents from, and you know, like what you know, who's my brother on a different continent.
Right.
It's this idea of how is the same 3 billion base code read out differently in each of the many hundreds of different cell types in the body, even though it is the same underlying instructions.
Right.
So this is. Something that I'm actively working on. It's got a lot to do with the three-dimensional structure. So actually what you find in different cell types is the 3D structures preserved. So the underlying code's the same, but the 3D structure's different. And that's what allows cells to do different things at different times. I think that's where a lot of the innovation and discoveries are really going to come from. It's not what the code is, but how and why and when it's read out as it is.
Let me ask you just a final question on genes, and then I'll move on. But if we are now able to base edit, and if we're able to identify single gene diseases where we can base edit out a gene which we are pretty confident is directly correlated with a pretty nasty and horrible disease, is there a case to be made not to just simply edit that out in every instance where we find it? I mean, why would we be troubled as a species if we were to just say, let's just generate unanimity that we should just base edit out this very pathological gene?
Yeah, I think it is only a matter of time until for the regulations to accept simple edits. I think the issue is just like, where do you stop? Like, if you're going to do one, why don't you do two base edits? Like, and why don't you edit some complicated things that might correlate with intelligence? So I think it's just people are afraid about the question of where does it stop when you start. And I think there'll just have to be a sensible discussion about it and agree at a point where we do stop. Because I think it's clear that giving people total control of the next generation's genome is not a good thing to do.
But we agree that we should start.
I think it's only a matter of time until we agree that we should start.
So we're now, arguably for the first time in human history, we will generate a consensus that we should start to base edit genes. And the most interesting, both technical and ethical debates of our time is going to be where to stop, but we're beyond the point of starting.
Well, in a way, we already have started, just not with good technology. Like, you can check if your prenatal tests and can tell you if your child's got Down syndrome, and then a lot of people are bored. So in a way, that is a crude way of base editing the next generation, just by deselecting a whole person. So I think we already have started, just with a very blunt tool.
Tell us a little bit about the, as supercomputing combined with AI seems to be very propitious that we have these capabilities at a time in which your ability to peer into realms that we haven't seen before reveal an entire universe of particles that we didn't know exist at an incredible scale. We're now able to process the data that we get from this new input at much higher rates. So tell us a little bit about how AI and supercomputing sort of has intersects with your field and enabled your field.
Right. I think there's two ways. One is in analysis of the data, because these kind of high resolution techniques generate an incredible amount of data. Like if you've got tenfold higher resolution in three dimensions, you get a thousandfold more data. So analysis is extremely helpful. I think one interesting way that it hasn't started happening yet, but it will be when an AI actually powers the tools itself. So you can kind of where you get automated discovery of biological phenomena, as where an AI drives a tool. So it could be a microscope, it could be some kind of sequencing device, it could be any number of other devices that extract information from biological systems. But where the AI can seek out phenomena on its own, I think we're going to see massively parallelized systems, which can essentially auto-discover dependencies and phenomena in biology, and I think that's a better use of AI in bio.
So for kind of civilians out there, give us a real world example of how an AI-empowered auto detection, what might be auto detected, which has a real world consequence of
right, right. Yeah. So we all know what's happening in computer vision right now. Like, it's one of the earliest real like consumer facing applications of AI, where it can detect items in images. Like, it can just see who your friends are on your iPhone camera, and like it can Google can classify images so you can search them easily. If you take that problem of image analysis and automated detection and just take it right over to microscopy, which is, microscopy is just a nanoscale video camera of what's going on in the cell, you can do the same thing. So you can auto-classify everything. And that, in a sense, is AI-powered discovery, just on a very small scale, using a very high-resolution camera. So I think we'll just literally see a transfer of that tech from computer vision straight into scientific discovery.
And this, you know, increasingly sounds like the realms of kind of far distant science fiction, sort of reverse telescoped into the present. But if you were to be as successful as your wildest dreams imagine them to be, give me two or three things that you think in the world of disease and human health that you think that we only dreamt of that may in the near term be possible.
I think, what we lack in biology is a kind of a unifying theory which allows us to actually make predictions and then develop products against them. And this is evidenced by the massive inefficiencies in the pharma industry, where they've essentially become marketing companies who just buy innovative-looking ideas off actual innovators. I think what we'll see is the actual innovators start to just take over the marketing and distribution of stuff they come up with. And that will lead to a big change in the kind of biopharma industry. I think it will be based on the stuff we've spoken about today, like systematic examinations of biological systems using very advanced tools, data science, and driven by AI, largely. This will allow us to actually measure biological systems, design interventions which do what we think they're going to do. And in the simplest form, that's a drug that works for a disease that we don't have one against right now. I think, the combination of technologies we can see now is pointing towards that. And I think it'll happen a lot faster than people think when we really start turning the handle on this.
So one set of things, you know, in layman's terms, the rate at which we are able to develop treatments for a whole set of very thorny diseases, or a much more targeted, much more effective, far fewer side effects, just, you know, develop a set of medicines that can treat disease in a wildly more effective way.
Yes.
Then there's a whole question of leave aside disease, just take the frailty of the human body and condition and this thing that we call aging. And there's a whole sort of frontier fraught with ethical problems about how we delay aging. Tell me a little bit about, you know, what your views are on that.
Yeah, I think there's two camps in aging. There's the lifespan people and there's the health span people. And they're quite different, actually, though they might sometimes go to the same conferences. health span people say, I don't mind dying. I just want to live well whilst I'm alive. And the lifespan people say, I don't want to die. And obviously one kind of implies the other. Like, if you extend lifespan radically, you probably will extend health span to some extent. But actually, if you extend health span, you know, you're still acknowledging there's a fundamental cap on the life of a human. I think it's kind of also inevitable that these technologies point towards that end goal. You only have to do kind of bio development of therapeutics for a while to just realize that, hold on a second, young people don't get sick and old people do. And just the incidence of every disease goes up as you age. So why are we bothering with cancer and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's? Why shouldn't we just tackle aging and think of that as a disease? So I think it's also an inevitable consequence that the tools enable us to look at this process. I haven't seen anything really good yet. There's a lot of hype. There's a lot of hype around stuff like Basis, which is sold by Elysium Health. Like, no one's radically altered the lifespan of humans yet. Like, even in mice, like, there's exciting experiments. They get like a 30, 40% increase in life. Nematodes, they've done a lot better. But like, nothing, there's a lot of hype. Like, I haven't actually seen anything really good yet. I think it's incredibly difficult. Problem. I think it probably will be solved.
So let's wrap up on a sort of a two questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. The first is impediments to what you're trying to do, right? Let's posit that what you're trying to do is radical, innovative, potentially change the human condition. And in some ways, there's kind of moral urgency to what you're trying to do. So what gets in the way and what could accelerate what you're doing?
I think the open-mindedness of the pharmaceutical industry gets in the way. It's like, it is enormous. It's responsible for, because they've got all the licensed therapies, and then they just print money off them, basically. And if they were more innovative in how they deployed that cash, I think we'd see a big acceleration in development of really exciting new stuff. There are some that are more progressive than others, but basically they're like marketing companies dressed up with a little bit of science. So I think that is a big macro theme that I think we'll see changing, and I'd love to see change, is the ability for people in biotech who innovate to be able to take their products all the way to market themselves. So that you need imaginative, risk-taking investment community. You need, because the timescales are so long, you need to be able to equip people with the expertise to go on a 10 to 15 year journey themselves. So I'd love to see like more young people taking on this highly risky kind of biotech journey, but with all these exciting enabling tools that are coming out. If you go to like biotech conference, it's a pretty old crowd. And that's because like the timescales to develop things are so long. So to be successful, you need to have been around for like 30 years, and then you might have got one thing developed in that time. As I said, the combination of these emerging technologies, I think, is going to speed that up, meaning that there's a proper startup culture around it.
And if you're a young person wanting to get into this field or excited by the potential of this field, what's your advice to them? What do you do?
I think go into one of these emerging fields, like go into genetics, go into areas of biology where there are tools being developed that shine a new light on processes, and then use them, and you will discover stuff, and that could become the basis of new companies and new research.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a fascinating conversation. We will follow your work closely and come and talk at The Conduit.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you will find more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers.